The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Finally, Mr. Speaker, last night the bill on Article 50 successfully completed its passage through both houses unchanged. It will now proceed to royal assent in the coming days, so we remain on track with the timetable I set out 6 months ago. And I will return to this House before the end of this month to notify when I have formally triggered Article 50 and begun the process through which the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. This will be a defining moment for our whole country as we begin to forge a new relationship with Europe and a new role for ourselves in the world. We will be a strong, self-governing, global Britain with control once again over our borders and our laws. And we will use this moment of opportunity to build a stronger economy and a fairer society so that we secure both the right deal for Britain abroad and a better deal for ordinary working people at home. And, Mr. Speaker, the new relationship with the EU that we negotiate will work for the whole of the United Kingdom. That is why we have been working closely with the devolved administrations. Including the Scottish Government, listening to their proposals and recognising the many areas of common ground that we have, such as protecting workers' rights and our security from crime and terrorism. So, Mr. Speaker, this is not a moment to play politics or create uncertainty. It is a moment to bring our country together, to honour the will of the British people and to shape for them a better, brighter future and a better Britain. And I commend this statement to the House.
That's British Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday in Parliament announcing that the bill triggering Article 50, the two-year Brexit procedure, it's cleared its way or passed the final hurdle in Parliament. And then she'll come out, as she said there, later this month, I guess, with the official announcement. But she talks about Britain moving on from Europe. And she talks about getting a deal that favors all of the United Kingdom. And yet, right at the same time that she's making this speech, or around the same time, coinciding with this, you have the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, announcing that she'll begin legal proceedings for another independence referendum to be held even before Britain officially leaves the EU, if she has her way. And so you have Great Britain at large pulling out of the European Union, and as that process is ongoing, you have this Scottish First Minister wanting to pull Scotland out of the UK. Now, you'll remember, many of you, that Scotland voted just 2.5 years ago. They voted to remain in the UK. And at the time, Ms. Sturgeon said that this was a once-in-a-generation vote. That's all that we're asking for here. Just once every 25, 30 years, maybe. And now it looks like it's going to be once every 5 years, I guess. Melanie Phillips said that Sturgeon timed this announcement to be as damaging and as disruptive as possible. As disruptive as possible to cause as much division as possible. And so now Britain's in a scenario where it has to fight the EU bureaucrats to try to get a favorable Brexit deal and to fight the Scottish nationalists to fight against the Remainers that are still there in Westminster, not to mention the Irish Republicans. Lots of division to go around. The Telegraph said this morning that it's as if Sturgeon handed the EU negotiators a stick to beat us with. They're going to hold her up. Certainly, I'll read another article here in just a second, where Vladimir Putin, he's ecstatic about this as well. The EU's ecstatic about this. Sturgeon's announcement, I mean. And Britain is left to try to hold everything together, to try to keep everything in Little Britain, what's left of Little Britain, to try to keep it together, even as it orchestrates this this two-year Brexit move. The Telegraph said, by calling for a second referendum on Scottish independence, when she knows there is maximum mischief to be made, Nicola Sturgeon proves herself to be not just dishonest, but a traitor to boot. Pretty strong. Pretty strong opinion piece here coming from the Telegraph. Instead of putting her padded shoulder to the wheel to help Theresa May get the best possible deal, the self-styled Queen of Scots goes behind the UK's back and flirts with the continent. She wants to leave the EU, or rather the UK, and flirt with the EU. Or flirt with Vladimir Putin and Russia. The Telegraph, this opinion piece, I didn't jot down the name of the piece or the author who wrote it, but he says, I'm struggling to think of a more poisonous display of political opportunism. That's what it all boils down to today, so often. Whether it's in Britain or the United States, it's all about politics. It's all about political opportunism. This is how much Sturgeon hates us, it says. The woman seemingly cares nothing for the United Kingdom, of which Scotland is such a precious and integral part. I mean, Scotland, you have the Stone of Scone in Edinburgh. You have part of the throne of David. The rock that was under that throne that used to rest there in Westminster Abbey. And now Scotland's wanting to break apart. It says she owes the UK no loyalty. In fact, it gives her sly pleasure to undermine it at every turn. Why now? Why announce that they're going to seek another referendum now? Well, like Melanie Phillips said, it's to do as much damage as possible. Anything to divide Great Britain. Sturgeon's contempt for the English is a given, it says. What is truly shocking is the way she prepared to play fast and loose with the future of her beloved Scots. I mean, this doesn't help Scotland out either. He goes on to say, I mean, when the checks stop coming from London, does Scotland really believe that the EU is going to swoop in and hand out all of this cash? Look at Greece. Look at some of the southern states, some of the southern members of the European Union. It says here, finally, why would you insist on holding a referendum concurrently with Brexit negotiations, causing a huge and costly distraction, when you could bide your time, wait until after 2020, the 2020 general election, and see how things pan out? Because, it says, it's all about her, that's why. See, it's political opportunism. And Britain is made to suffer for it. Here comes another huge and costly distraction. Even as Britain tries to orchestrate all of these deals, not just with the EU as it leaves, but with other nations too, trade deals and such. Well, there's another piece in the Telegraph that talks about how much the Kremlin is loving all of this. No one's more delighted by Sturgeon's decision than Vladimir Putin. He's been one that's dismissed Britain publicly, saying it's just a small island, you know, that no one really listens to. But Putin's well aware of NATO, an organization dominated by the United States, and then to a lesser degree, Britain. Britain has a prominent position to play in that alliance as well. And Putin would love nothing better than to see it break apart. to see the NATO alliance weaken. It's already weakening, given the positions of the Trump administration. And yet, if he can diminish Britain's status or position in NATO, that's all the better. The Telegraph says here, there's nothing the Russian leader would like more than to diminish Britain's status as a major power in the realms of defense and security. It says, and the Russians will certainly be calculating that the effectiveness of Britain's national security infrastructure will be severely compromised if the SNP succeeds in its quest to remove Scotland from the rest of the United Kingdom. It goes on and talks about how critical Scotland is to Britain's defense. The most obvious casualty of the creation of an independent Scotland would be the network of military bases used to protect Britain's northern flank from the Russian threat. That includes Fosling, the operational base on the Scottish west coast for the fleet of the Vanguard submarines used to carry the Trident nuclear weapon system. We've talked about this before. We talked about it in the lead up to the referendum in 2014. Now that this was a hot topic, what if Scotland votes to leave? What are we going to do with Britain's nukes? There was one vice admiral that said that it could go so far as to cause Britain to abandon nuclear weapons. Here's the third largest nuclear power in the world. And these Trident nuclear missiles are situated in Scotland. It's the UK's strongest deterrent. It's all there in Scotland. What would happen to those nukes? Well, who knows? And leave that aside again. Just look at the internal division and strife. Even as there's all of this talk about Britain going on and being strong and self-governing and being a global Britain. But look at little Britain. Even as it negotiates Brexit, all the squabbling and the division and the strife and the jeering when the Prime Minister speaks, that yes, we've been working closely with all of these other administrations, these other governments, from Scotland to Wales to Northern Ireland. And then as she says that, the Scottish contingent just breaks out in laughter. You heard it. Is Britain united? The Telegraph says here, and irrespective of Fosling's fate, the creation of an independent Scotland would, at the very least, cause major disruption to Britain's military infrastructure, as London would need to review conventional defense arrangements such as air defense, maritime surveillance, radar, and air sea rescue. So it's more than just the nukes. Everything would have to be restructured. If these are some of the more practical examples of how Scottish independence could weaken Britain's defenses, I mean, as if they need to be any weakened any further. They're already weak. Britain's already a shell of its former self. It says here, well, it just talks about the kind of relationship that, I mean, leave aside the fact that Scotland would go off on its own, but then to think about the kind of relationship an independent Scotland might have with Vladimir Putin. Well, that just brings the Russian threat that much closer to little England. Senior members of the SNP make no secret of their admiration of Mr. Putin's Russia, says the Telegraph, which is best summed up by former SNP leader Alex Salmond's crass remark back in 2014 to the effect that Mr. Putin deserved praise for restoring Russian pride by his annexation of Crimea. Here's the former SNP leader. Well, Putin should be praised for annexing Crimea. Putin should receive praise for devouring little Crimea. It says here, since then, that's 2014, since then the SNP's Kremlin love-in has deepened to the extent that the Scottish government has allowed the Russian Sputnik news agency to open an office in central Edinburgh, from whence it runs its propaganda war against the rest of the UK. So here's Scotland reaching out to Russia, reaching out, the Scottish government that is, reaching out to Russia, reaching out to the EU, and now announcing that we're going to have another referendum, or we're going to put in motion the legal documents that call for another referendum as Britain becomes more and more divided. It says here, finally, behind this facade lies a more sinister agenda, namely the destruction of Britain as a major world power. Well, I think we could argue that it's already been destroyed, at least as a major world power. It's already been destroyed. I mean, there was a time when Britain ruled 57 colonies, dominions, territories, and protectorates. It ruled the continent of Australia, the subcontinent of India. It ruled all or parts of dozens of other countries: Ireland, South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Egypt, Israel, Cyprus, Kuwait, Iraq, Afghanistan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Fiji, New Zealand, the Caribbean, territories in Central America, of course, Canada, even America. The list just goes on and on and on. I mean, that was Great Britain. That was Great Britain, greater than Rome of old, the greatest, most powerful empire in history. And now what's left of it? Well, of what's left of it, Scotland wants to leave, or at least the leadership does. And if Scotland left, then what would stop Wales or Northern Ireland? And if that happened, what are you left with? Well, Richard Palmer had a piece today. It's featured at the top of thetrumpet.com. Here we go again, he says. Here we go again. I mean, this happened in 2014, just 2.5 years ago. Richard writes, Britain is already struggling with one uncertainty that will affect the country for generations to come, its post-Brexit relationship with the EU. Britain has voted to leave the EU, but much still remains uncertain. What will the UK's new relationship with the EU be like? What trade agreements will Britain have with the rest of the world? With another Scottish independence referendum on the line, the UK will once again be asking, will we continue to exist? So that's what the British government is facing. Okay, here's what we need to negotiate to pull out of the EU. And oh yes, there's this other matter. Are we going to even exist as Great Britain? The largest empire in world history. The sun never set on the British Empire. I mean, that was literally true, that statement, that saying. There was a time when London, the government in London, there was a time when it governed about 20% of the population of the world. There was an article at Politico a couple of years ago titled The Sad Dark End of the British Empire. This was a piece that came out in the lead up to that first referendum at the end of 2014. And Political said, today that empire has been reduced to 14 scattered islands, such as the British Virgin Islands in the Caribbean and Pitcairn Island in the South Pacific. The Commonwealth of Nations, founded before World War II and revived after the war, comprises 54 former British territories, but is little more than a monument to the empire. Now the wave of disillusion is lapping up against the shores of the British Isles themselves. It spread all over the earth at one time. The sun never set on the British Empire. And now this wave of division, it's pushing up against the shores of the British Isles. Richard Palmer had another piece in the lead up to that referendum in 2014, talking about what it would mean if Scotland voted to leave. And again, they didn't. A majority said, let's stay. But now, 2.5 years later, the Scottish government wants to put it out there again in hopes of leaving. Obviously, in hopes of leaving. And should that happen, as Richard wrote back in 2014, it would be the end of Britain as a first-rate military power. And then he paraphrased what my father said in one of his articles about how, I mean, just as far as undermining Britain and its moral stance, how could you go around telling other countries how to remain unified or to solve their internal problems or affairs when Britain can't even hold its own country together? Brad McDonald also in the lead up to that referendum. He had a piece at the Trumpet. All these are at the Trumpet. You should search for them. You can get quite a lot of context. All that's happened here in the UK over the last couple days, you can get everything that you need to know at thetrumpet.com, our new website, the one that was relaunched just on Friday. Well, we're featuring a piece right there today at the top of the website by Richard Palmer. Here we go again. Scotland to hold another independence referendum. Well, this other one, Brad McDonald from a few years ago, he talks about the decline of Britain as an empire and just the decline of British pride. No one has provided, he said, no one has provided a rousing positive vision of what it would mean to remain part of Britain. No one has reminded the Scots of their illustrious history with England. No one has reminded them of what England and Scotland have accomplished together and provided a vision of what they could accomplish together in the future. There once was a dream called Britain. Being British meant something. Changing the world, righting wrongs, civilizing distant lands. But now, the world is not our problem. There are no rights and wrongs, just British neocolonialist arrogance, and sadly a prevailing sense of shame of its history. This is an article, by the way, that Richard quotes in his piece featured at the top of the website this morning. He quotes this piece from a couple of years ago at thetrumpet.com. Brad McDonald asking, where is the hope-filled vision of Scotland's destiny should it remain united with England? There isn't one. There isn't one. Why? Because England doesn't know what it means to be English. And consequently, it doesn't have a clear vision of its own destiny. Well, go and look at that article. Read Richard's first, and you'll see a link to Brad McDonald's piece there toward the end of Richard's article. But notice this passage over here in Hosea 2. We've read this before with respect to Britain. God has a lot to say, even though there's plenty of people in the world today who scoff at the prophecies of God, who say that these ancient verses in Hosea and elsewhere, they have nothing to do with Britain. They have nothing to do with anyone in the world. It's all ancient history. It all applies to what happened thousands of years ago. God, obviously, he doesn't agree with that. The Bible's been written and recorded for our time today. Read 1 Corinthians 10. See what Paul said there about how all of this is recorded for our learning. It's for us. And so much of the Bible is prophecy, a third of it at least. And most of that is for our time today, the end time. Hosea 2:8, it says, for she did not, this is speaking of Ephraim, biblical Ephraim, which is Great Britain today. For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Look at all of the power and the wealth. All of these territories, these dominions, these colonies, these protectorates. Massive, massive territories. Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa, India. And then all of the smaller ones. Together with that, God gave it all to the British people. He gave it all to the people of Ephraim. But she doesn't know this. That's what it says in Hosea 2 and verse 8. She doesn't know. Verse 9 says, therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof, and my wine in the season thereof, and will recover my wool and my flax, given to cover her nakedness. And now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of my hand. That's all the choice that she's really left with, to put her trust in lovers. And it's because of these prophecies. It's because of rebellion. It's because of sin. It's because of division, strife. Decades and decades of prophecies going back to Herbert Armstrong's ministry. I mean, just look at the United States and Britain and prophecy itself. But you add to that all of the plain truth articles, dozens and dozens of them. Quite a few of them there in the 1960s, some 50, 60 years ago, talking about what Britain would be facing, the economic problems and the struggles with the Commonwealth, the division, the unsustainable welfare system, the notorious laziness, immorality, gross immorality, the upside-down family. The plain truth was, it was saying back in the days of the 1960s that Britain was increasingly seen as the sick man of Europe. Here again, as it negotiates to leave the EU, it now has to turn further inward and try to keep things together internally. To try to keep Great Britain from unraveling. What's left of Great Britain from unraveling? Well, we better get to God's opinion on this. We better go to the Bible and see what he has to say, because the Bible tells us that it's God who makes and unmakes nations. It's God, we just read it in Hosea 2, it's God who made Great Britain great. And it's God who's unmaking Great Britain today. It really is that simple. Look at Hosea 5 and verse 3. A couple pages over, staying here in the prophet Hosea's book. Hosea 5 and verse 3, it says, I know Ephraim and Israel is not hid from me, God says. Verse 4, they will not frame their doings to turn unto their God. They won't turn to me. They won't turn to me. And then over in chapter 7, God says that Ephraim is like a silly dove. A silly dove. It says further, without heart, they call to Egypt, they go to Assyria. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. I'll bring them down as the fowls of the heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation has heard. It says, I mean, that's chapter 7 over in chapter 9. It says, finally, my God will cast them away because they did not hearken unto him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations. These are the great prophecies of God that Mr. Armstrong repeatedly referred back to in warning the British people. And so, like we were saying, just in the lead up to Brexit, like we were saying after Brexit, and now the Brexit process has begun, and now here's another referendum called for in Scotland, as we've been saying all the way through these crises, these divisions. The British people need to wake up to see what's happening in this world, to see what God says in his prophecies, to study those prophecies, and to study further about the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, the United States of Europe. We taped a program on this just yesterday afternoon, putting together some of the materials we've covered on this show over the last several weeks, going to those prophecies in Revelation 17, Daniel 2, of course. We said all along that Britain would be on the outside of Europe, that is, this now forming empire in Europe. And we've said all along that Britain would lose the empire. Look at the direction. Look at the direction of Europe. Look at the direction of Britain. Oh, there may be some short-term optimism, given the new administration in the United States and the talk of these bilateral trade agreements. But just give it a little bit more time and note the trajectory. What's happening in British government and what's happening on the continent of Europe, particularly in Germany. Herbert Armstrong was right about all of these developments, and he was right about Britain. Britain was certainly warned by Herbert W. Armstrong. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Revelation 6 stands out as an important chapter because of how it locks in with another one of Jesus Christ's prophecies. The glorified Christ revealed these future events to John in Revelation 6, and it was Jesus Christ as a human being, God in the flesh, who prophesied these same events in Matthew 24, the same Christ. In the traditional Christian world, we hear a lot about Christ as our sacrifice, our Savior. But how about Jesus Christ the prophet? That's exactly what he was. His gospel and his whole message revolved around prophecy. So to know Christ means to know about the prophecies he spoke in Revelation and in Matthew. This free booklet, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, shows that what Christ prophesied in Matthew 24 is primarily for the end time. For more than five decades, Herbert W. Armstrong declared a powerful and consistent warning about the dramatic fulfillment of end-time prophecy. Using the Bible as his guide, Mr. Armstrong made bold predictions about the course of world events long before they occurred. He was right encapsulates what he boldly proclaimed for more than 50 years. This free booklet will build your faith in the certainty of biblical prophecy. Request He Was Right and The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Both booklets are offered free of charge at no cost or obligation to you. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Just a couple more news items here that I wanted to make you aware of before we conclude with a short Bible study. From Foreign Policy Today, you have the Geert Wilders effect. I believe down in the Netherlands, they've got their big election going on today. It says here in Foreign Policy, in the weeks leading up to the vote, the Dutch have been preoccupied, almost obsessed with issues of immigration, integration, and national identity. That's saying that even if Mr. Wilders loses today, or if he's still in the minority, he's already won because of his influence. It says later, if the right sweeps the board, the liberal project, we say project now rather than consensus, it will be history, it says. Though it may tempt the gods to say so, it's far likelier that the center-right will win all three ballots. The PVV has been sinking in the polls in recent weeks. The party is now expected to take about 25 of the 150 seats in parliament, as is the VVD. I'm not as familiar with Dutch politics, but I'm sure our listeners in the Netherlands are familiar with these political groups. It says, but neither the VVD or any other mainstream party would accept the PVV as part of a governing coalition. Wilders, in short, will remain in the opposition, but that does not mean that he is lost. He has so thoroughly reshaped Dutch political culture that voters who share his views but find him ultra vires or beyond the pale can now vote for any number of parties that have taken a hard line on immigrants and on Islam, including the VVD itself. So basically, he's had an impact, and the attitude is changing. We've noted this with respect to Germany in particular, but it's happening all across Europe. The attitude is changing. Another story here from the Times of London speaks of Putin's move into Libya, and how that this should be another wake-up call. It talks about how that, if you remember, when Putin was going into Syria, it was President Obama, then president, saying that, oh, he's just going to get bogged down. It's going to be a quagmire. Remember that? A quagmire. Well, now he's saved the Assad regime. He's still in Syria. Now he's moving into Libya. The real quagmire, as the Times brings out here, is the diplomatic one headed up by then Secretary of State John Kerry and then President of the United States, Barack Obama. Putin's settling into his role as the new regional power broker quite nicely. It's not much of a quagmire. He's moving into targets all over the region or areas that he's targeting. That's at the Times of London. Just a couple more pieces there that I thought we needed to at least touch on before concluding today's show. Yesterday in our college forum, I encouraged our students at the college and at the academy to really take advantage of the opportunity that that they have there before them, and how that it's common today for people to have a tremendous opportunity, but to not really realize it as it's happening, to take it for granted. Herbert Armstrong, in fact, when he talked about just the whole educational system in the West, the method, the teaching of things that they should just instill in their memories, it's based on the habit of assuming without question whatever's just commonly accepted, carelessly taking things for granted, in other words. Look over at Luke chapter 4. There's a powerful lesson in this, looking at it from a spiritual perspective as well. When you think about the truth of God and looking at the ministry of Jesus Christ in particular, here he was, as my father has said before, he was from outer space. He was the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Well, the Word came in the flesh to this little speck in the universe, to Earth. This was God in the flesh. Well, in Luke 4, he has the titanic struggle or confrontation with Satan the devil, Jesus Christ and Satan the devil. And then he's moved to go throughout Galilee And it says in the scriptures that his fame went throughout the region, and he taught in the synagogues. This is verse 16 of Luke 4. It says, and he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read. So here he's in his hometown. He's around all these people that were familiar with him and his family, his physical family. And he preached from the book of Isaiah. He talked about how that these prophecies were being fulfilled right before their eyes. Prophecies being fulfilled. And the crowd there said, well, who, isn't this Joseph's son? Who is he to say these sorts of things, to make these kinds of dogmatic statements? And wasn't he just a carpenter? Isn't he from a family of carpenters? He didn't have any rabbinical training. It says in verse 23, and he said unto them, you will surely say unto me this proverb, physician, heal yourself. Whatsoever we have heard done in Capernaum, do also here in your country. And he said, verily I say unto you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. So he wasn't received very well in Nazareth, the place that he was brought up. In and around Galilee, it was a different story. But in Nazareth, well, you can read the rest of it. I won't take the time to go through it. I mean, he talks about some history that these Jews should have been familiar with. History with respect to Elijah and Elisha of old. And then he gets to the end of his discussion there. And it says in verse 29 that the people there in Nazareth, hearing him speak, they rose up, they thrust him out of the city, they led him unto the brow of the hill whereon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong. So they took him out to a cliff in Nazareth. So angry with Christ, one of their very own, that they tried to kill him. Well, he made his escape, and he went back to Capernaum, that city in Galilee, and he taught them on the Sabbath days, it says there. And in Capernaum, it says they were astonished at his doctrine. They were astonished. The ones in Nazareth, though, they didn't receive him. No prophet is accepted in his own country. He's rejected. Or maybe he's taken for granted. Or maybe there's the assumption that, well, he'll always be around. We can always come back and check in later. And here they had the truth from the Son of God right in front of them. And they rejected it. Matthew chapter 13. Notice this. In Matthew 13 and verse 53, it says here, and it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed thence. And when he was come into his own country, he taught them in their synagogue. So here he is again in his own country. People were familiar with him there. It says that they were astonished and said, whence has this man this wisdom and these mighty works? I mean, they acknowledged that he had wisdom and that he was performing miracles. But then they say, is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary and his brothers, James, Josie, and Simon, and Judas, and his sisters? Are they not all with us? Whence then has this man all these things? I mean, his brothers and sisters aren't like this. So what makes this one so special? It says, and they were offended in him. They were offended. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor, save in his own country, just like we read in Luke 4. But he adds here, and in his own house. Even in his own family. They didn't really realize who it was that was in their midst, what it was that they were receiving from him. The scriptures say that he did not many mighty works there because of their unbelief. They didn't have the belief. They didn't have the faith. And so Christ couldn't perform mighty works there in his own country, in his own city, in his own family. Well, you know some of the other accounts in the Gospels, even his disciples. Peter, I mean, who can forget Peter forsaking him during Jesus Christ's greatest trial, even after saying, I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. And what did he end up doing? Well, Peter, of course, turned it around. He received God's Spirit later on in the story, and he went all the way for God. There was no doubting his loyalty at the end of the story. But that example from the Gospels, it certainly shows how easy it is to talk about being loyal, to talk about taking things very seriously, and to not take it for granted. And yet, how many of us go about our day-by-day routine and just carelessly assume certain things or make decisions based upon assumptions rather than really appealing to God, being instant in prayer, continuing in prayer, as the Bible says, to really seek His guidance and direction? Read Jeremiah 17, verse 10. We need His guidance. We need His intervention. We need His inspiration. Over here in the Epistle of Jude, toward the end of the New Testament, just before the book of Revelation, notice what it says in Jude 1. This is Jude, verse 1. It says, Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ, and brother of James, to them that are sanctified by God the Father and preserved in Jesus Christ and called. Jude says there, he introduces himself and he says, I'm the servant of Jesus Christ and the brother of James. Here was Christ's brother calling him a servant, calling himself a servant of Christ rather than the brother of Christ. My father made some pretty powerful observations on this in his little booklet on this epistle of Jude. He said Jude called himself a slave of Jesus Christ. He didn't call himself the brother of Christ. He only called himself the brother of James, who also was Christ's brother. Why did Jude make this omission, calling himself a slave and not a brother? It says perhaps he was remaining humble, thinking, I waited so long before responding to my brother. I'm not even worthy to be called the brother of Christ. Maybe he referred to himself this way because of how long it took him to finally realize what was right there in front of him, to appreciate the truth of God, to appreciate dwelling in the presence of God in the flesh. My father says Jude grew up with the Logos. He was a normal human being who just happened to be reared. He was a normal human being who just happened to be reared and who grew up right alongside a man from outer space. That's awesome to think about. He grew up in the same house with this man from outer space. This man who was perfect in every respect. My father says, I think you can see why Jude would have had difficulty with that. His brother was the Logos, the spokesman for God the Father. But by this time, Jude was a different man, a deeply repentant man. He knew who his brother really was. Do we really know the living God and his Son, Jesus Christ? Do we know where God's true church is? Do we hear the truth? Do we respond to God's truth as it comes through that church, through the body of Christ? Jude felt pretty bad that it took him as long as it did to wake up and to appreciate what it was that he grew up with and to not take it for granted. There's this wonderful example over in Luke 7 showing that God is no respecter of persons. It's an emotional example, really, and just reading it yesterday, it's hard not to get a little bit choked up at just the attitude here. And what you see on display and the lessons that Jesus Christ leaves for us in all of these encounters during his ministry, I mean, it's all there recorded for our benefit, for our learning, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10. Four gospel accounts. The living Jesus Christ. God's word, of course, the Bible, is Jesus Christ in print. And there it is. It's on our bookshelf. It's in our home. It's right there next to us. Do we appreciate it the way that we should? Do we value it? Do we realize what we have right in front of us? Toward the end of his life, Jude, he referred to himself as a slave of Jesus Christ. Because, well, maybe he thought, I'm not even worthy to be called his brother. I mean, after all, I waited so long. I waited so long before responding to the message that he preached. Luke 7, notice verse 36, sorry. Luke 7 and verse 36, it says, and one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. So here was a Pharisee who invited him over for dinner. And he went into the Pharisee's house and sat down to meat. And behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment and stood at his feet behind him, weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears and did wipe them with the hairs of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee, which had bidden him, saw it, he spoke within himself, saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that touches him, for she is a sinner. I mean, here's the Pharisee questioning Christ's credentials, doubting whether or not he's a prophet now, just because he didn't throw this woman out of the house. Verse 40, Jesus, of course, discerned all of this. It says in verse 40, and Jesus answering said unto him, Simon, I have somewhat to say unto you. And he said, Master, say on. And he called him Master. Christ encountered a lot of Pharisees like this. They called him Lord and Master. And what did he say to them? Why don't you do the things I say? It's easy to talk about religion. It's easy to say you're righteous. Well, verse 41, here's the parable. There was a certain creditor which had two debtors, and one owed 500 pence and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most? Well, Simon the Pharisee answered and said, well, I suppose it's he to whom he forgave most. And he said unto him, you have rightly judged. Notice verse 44, and he turned to the woman, and he said to Simon, see you this woman? I entered into your house, and you gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Simon didn't offer Christ anything, but this sinful woman came in with ointment, bowed down before Christ, washed his feet with tears, wiped them off with the hairs from her head. Verse 45 says, you gave me no kiss, Simon, but this woman, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil you did not anoint, but this woman has anointed my feet with ointment. It says in verse 47, wherefore I say unto you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. See, you think you're so righteous and you know so much already that you don't need me. You take me and my ministry and the truth of God that I'm preaching for granted. And the truth of the matter is that you don't have much love. This woman, who wasn't even from this household, caught wind of the fact that Christ was in there, and look at what she did. She was appreciative. She didn't take the ministry of Christ for granted. She didn't take the preaching of Christ for granted, or all the miracles that he performed. She waltzed right into the home and just, well, we read it. She started carrying on her service to the Son of God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.